Welcome to Restoring the Mind. My name is Khalid Mahmood. Today's topic is Ukraine crisis. Truth behind the headlines. My guest this week, once again, is Thomas Pichari. He writes on World Affairs Monthly. Welcome to Restoring the Mind, Tom.
Yeah, hi, Khalid. Once again, it's great to talk to you. I hope everything's going okay.
Oh, it's good. It's good to hear your voice again. I have a question about Ukraine. Why has all of a sudden has Ukraine become such an important issue? I mean, there was no such threat during the COVID peak time when COVID was kind of, but let's say 18 months ago or something like that. Okay, so why now? Why has suddenly Ukraine become top of the list of global crisis?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question, and it's suddenly, yes, it's really gained prominence. I'm gonna say, as usual, that we want to go back in history, and so I'm gonna tell a bit of a history story, and then explain, you know, my point with the history. So, Russia was always very backward. And, you know, several centuries ago, it was really backward compared to Western Europe. Western Europe, in, you know, in 1500, had a bourgeoisie population of about 15% of the total population. You know, most everybody was farmers, and it was a small aristocratic class or monarchy or whatever. So, you know, bourgeoisie was actually quite large. Bourgeoisie, you know, everybody knows what that is, okay? People with prominence, people with land, educated people, higher income people, you know. All right, so professional.
Kind of the feudal lords.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's right. So the feudal life that was dominant during the Dark Ages and Middle Ages kind of gave way to this, in Western Europe, in France, Germany, and England, gave way to this really dynamic system where the bourgeoisie demanded more and more influence in how things were run. You know, and so, you know, like I said, around 1500, 1600 in Western Europe, the bourgeoisie class actually numbered about 15% of the total population, which is quite astonishing. You know? But if you look at the same time further east into Eastern Europe and Russia, I don't think the bourgeoisie, I don't have the numbers, but I'm sure the numbers were very small. You had a monarchy, you know, run system. And of course, at the same time, it had a very small bourgeoisie. Now it was probably not that small, but it was just not nearly as dynamic and large and influential as the one in Western Europe. And so then you just go, you know, history's moving on, and then you have this French Revolution, which is really interesting because, you know, the French have always been really dynamic, and they began to, the bourgeoisie in France, you know, around the late 1700s, began to realize that, you know, we can't really tolerate this incompetent monarchy. You know, the French king ruled over France, and he had the institution of French kings goes back 1,000 years, and almost, you know, it's a very important institution, of course, and very resolute and you know, not very dynamic, you know, just the old fashioned. The king decreed, you know, everybody knows what the king does. All right, so The bourgeoisie said, no, this is garbage. This is incompetence, too much incompetence. We want a role in how things are you know, governed and organized and all that. We want a role in how things are run. And of course, it's commonly thought that the peasant class, or the other farmers, which were obviously the dominant people in France at the time, maybe, you know, way dominant over bourgeoisie, they didn't really have a role. They were just basically victims of periodic famines. You know, so it was the bourgeoisie that created the French Revolution. And this guy, Robespierre, probably people can look him up on the net, Robespierre, people, he's pretty famous. He proposed, with others, that they actually execute the monarchy, the members of the family, the king's family. And they wanted to do that because they wanted to really put an end to the garbage governance that they had suffered for so many centuries. And, you know, maybe the king was competent at times, You know, I'm sure. I'm not sure. I want to say the king was always incompetent. The kings were always incompetent. But you know, it just became obvious that information, as we've talked about before, was becoming very important, very dominant, and the bourgeoisie had a very big role in governance because their proficiency in the information world. All right, so they did execute the royal family with the guillotine. You know, they killed the king, they killed a lot of people. I think up to 20,000 members of the French family anyway, so the royal family. And that didn't really do the job, though. Robespierre was hoping that it would do the job, but the French public kind of allowed this thing to, they called it the terror, to get out of hand. So before you know it, everybody's kind of denouncing their neighbors. You know, they want to get rid of an enemy they had, and they denounce them as a monarchist or whatever supporter, not supporting the French Revolution. And so they would get guillotined. So then finally they put an end to the terror, which was the executions going on all the time. And so Robespierre himself was executed because he was kind of like, anyway. So my point is that the world is moving on, right? The world's moving on. And then you look further east and you have just no moving on whatsoever. Very backward, you know, very, very backward. And maybe that's a function of the environment, the ecology, you know, the cold, you know, I don't know, but it was very backward and very, very low literacy compared to Western Europe, et cetera. So then you have these Jewish people, Ashkenazi Jews, and I've talked about them before with you, but you know, they were driven further east over the centuries after they got liberated by Napoleon and his armies. They were driven eastward because people in Western Europe didn't like them very much. You know, they had a bad reputation for all sorts of reasons. So they were driven into Russia, into Eastern Europe. And Catherine the Great, who I think might have been German, actually German, she decreed that they set up a place for the Jews to live because they didn't want them to mix with the Orthodox Russians and the peasants. Peasants were always complaining about the Jews anyway, so they ended up in the Pale of Settlement. So my argument is going toward this: the Russian nation only became really viable in the Western sense when the Jewish people, Ashkenazi Jews, created this Bolshevik revolution, and it really got out of hand. You know, maybe most of them, these Jews, I'm going to say that they're kind of kooky. You know, they believe in this stuff. They believed in communism. You know, but it was a killing operation. I mean, Solzhenitsyn said they, from 1920 or to 1960, they killed. The Soviet regime killed about 60 million people. So it was just a bloodthirsty annihilation of the bourgeoisie, the little nascent bourgeoisie that was developing in Eastern Europe and Russia. So you really don't have a bourgeoisie anymore in Russia. It's gone, totally annihilated. I mean, exterminated. You know, you have a very small class of people like Vladimir Putin. I can't remember what age he is, but I think he's probably a little older than me, and I'm 63. Maybe. Do you happen to know how old he is, Gellert?
No, I'm not sure.
Okay. So Putin comes from a pretty humble, you know, actually everybody in Russia. They're from simple people, peasants, and so Russia today is this totally wiped out, controlled, weird place. Vast territory, but with huge natural resources, huge. Like, the amount of oil that they have is mind-boggling. In fact, crude oil. In fact, I just read yesterday or the day before in preparation for this interview that they expect to increase their crude oil production this year, 2022, by 8%. So the amount of oil and natural gas and coal and other natural resources in Russia is truly mind-boggling. And because they were not that developed for a long time, these resources are probably quite plentiful. And if, for example, that I'm assuming this is true, but you know, I don't have a way to confirm this, but I'll bet you the resource potential of Russia is still really considerable, meaning that, you know, the United States is tapped out in terms of crude oil. We have the tight oil, and that's about it. But Russia probably could go up much higher in terms of crude oil production. So I tend to think, and this is just my best guess, and I hope the audience considers this thesis, is that the toppling of Putin, who is a Russian, you know, Soviet nationalist, who's kind of hankering for the old days, really, you know, of authoritarian government, and hoping to kind of, you know, keep the Soviet system alive to some degree. Meaning
he's 69, by the way.
Okay, thank you. So he's a little bit older than me, but the fact is he's the older generation in Russia that want to kind of, you know, I'm not saying they hanker for the old days, but you know, he's openly said that the disaster, the biggest disaster for Russia, was letting go of the Soviet Union. You know, so okay, so we know his opinion on that. I tend to think that, getting to the point, answering your question directly, Ashkenazi Jews who don't totally control the United States, they decide everything. Yeah, they control the media, they decide everything. They actually come from Ukraine, and they come from Poland. Those were the two areas in the Pale of Settlement. They want to actually own Ukraine again. Not only that, they want to get all the way up to the border of Russia, and they want to topple this Putin regime, which is not to their liking, and they want to control Russia, and they want to control Russia because they know that they must have the crude oil and the natural gas. So this is a replay of Iraq. You know, this is a replay of Libya. Libya's actual crude production is going down because they, you know, these Hillary Clinton doing the bidding of Ashkenazi Jews in Washington. You know, she killed this, killed off this Libyan regime, you know, Muammar Gaddafi. Anyway, so that's my answer. Now, I tend to think that this is going to be very dangerous, potentially dangerous, because Putin knows about me and my theories. You know, undoubtedly he does. In fact, I remember it was like 2005, some woman emailed me and said she was a trainer for Putin, and Putin wanted to talk to me and meet me, and that I should do training, physical training too, weightlifting and this kind of thing. All right, now I didn't think she was real at first, but she claimed she was. So I tend to think that this Russian policy of preventing NATO from going all the way up to the border of Russia is extremely serious. So now, the desperation on the part of the Jews, Ashkenazi Jews, I'll just call them Ashkenazim, is actually pretty extreme. You know, they know that their prosperity story is got to continue if they want to remain in power, right? They know that. And they've got to get the oil. They got the Iraq oil. It was at 1.4 million barrels a day with Saddam Hussein when he was caged up in his, you know, before, with the sanctions in 1999 or whatever, something like that, and maybe even less. And now it's, you know, it's about 4 million, but they're having trouble getting it up to 5. I don't know, maybe it's 5 million, I have to look. But, you know, they can't really go up. They had thought that Iraq was like another Saudi Arabia, but it's not. And Saudi Arabia, there's rumors that they can't, you know, they really can't go higher. They don't have a spare capacity anymore to speak of, maybe a million barrels a day. We don't know, million barrels a day. We don't know. So no one knows. But the price of fuel is going up. And once the price of fuel gets high enough, there's going to be a lot of angry people out there. And the prosperity that the Jews must have to rule is going to be in jeopardy. So they want Ukraine because they can, if they can get next to into Ukraine, they right up against the border of Russia.
Okay.
Final point I would make is that in the early 90s there was a talk There was, I think, George Kennan, and, you know, very when he was still alive, very famous people, diplomats in the United States, argued that we should not expand NATO. You know, a few countries, Eastern Europe, fine, but, you know, and but that didn't happen. It's expanded. Everybody wants to join NATO, you know, for all sorts of reasons. But so there's my thesis, and I'm pretty much finished with that argument. I think so. So the potential for conflict is there because the desperation is really rising in among the Ashkenazim who rule here, and also the desperation is rising among the Russians and Putin and the people who want to keep Russia from being swamped. You know, they don't want the sodomy routine in Russia. They don't want it, right? And I call it, jokingly, I call it Sodom. I'm not as good a comic as Ukraine. Well, maybe I am. But the sodomy routine is not welcome in Russia. Mm-hmm. And the sodomy routine is promoted by Ashkenazim.
Okay. So you don't think that there is going to be any conflict in Ukraine anytime soon?
Well, usually I'm going to say that no, there won't be, because Russian military power is immense, presumably. However, the Ukrainians do have manpads, and you know, they do have some pretty good weaponry that the United States has given them, or NATO has given them, and they have these Turkish drones, so they could do some damage. But I would argue that the Afghan, so-called Afghan government, supported by the United States and NATO, was a joke and proved to be a joke. And I would argue that the same is probably true for Ukraine. So if Vladimir Putin and his advisors decide they want to go in a blitzkrieg and do it, invade and take control, physical control of Ukraine, they would probably, I would say that they almost surely see the collapse of the Ukrainian forces and Ukrainian government, probably. But, you know, there might be some chance of some resistance, although I doubt it. So, but I don't think they want to do that. What they want to do is they want to show this Ashkenazim that, you know, all right, we have all the natural gas, we have a lot of crude oil, we're going to kick your ass. Yeah, so they would prefer not to, but they don't want Ukraine becoming part of NATO. And I think the Ukrainian government now is saying, no, everything's okay. We don't want to be part of the West. We don't want to be NATO, you know, right? Isn't there some of that going on?
Yes. You know, you mentioned a lot about the Jews kind of not being interested in Ukraine. And yeah. In Russia as well, but for some reason I don't. Well, there's not much mention, much statements coming out of Israel at all, and yeah. Israel has been totally silent on this topic.
Well, I'm glad you raised this. Okay, I'm going to say, you know, I looked it up. 200,000 to 400,000 estimated Ashkenazi Jews living in Ukraine.
Okay,
that's a lot of Jews that could. That's a lot of Ashkenazi Jews that could move to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So we could argue, and I think you're hinting at that this might be just another ploy to drive Ashkenazi Jews in Ukraine, and you know, say almost a 500,000 of them into Israel for a Greater Israel project.
Interesting.
So maybe that's the aim. That's one of the aims. One of the aims. Yeah.
But one country that is more active than others in trying to bring peace or trying to have a peace treaty, you know, negotiate some kind of peace settlement is Turkey.
Yeah.
I mean, why is Turkey so interested in peace?
Well, you know, you mentioned the other day, and I didn't know this, I confess. I mean, I don't know everything, and I wish I did know it at the time, but Turkey was actually, the Ottomans actually had much of the Ukrainian nation territory during at the height of the Ottoman Empire. So they actually were in there, you know. And so they have historic ties with this land called Ukraine. So I think maybe the Turks, they're just desperate to do whatever they can to survive, and they look to their former territories, Ottoman Empire territories, for assistance, you know, for cooperation. And you told me also that that the Turkish drones that are obviously extremely capable and pretty damn impressive, they are getting engines or other parts of the technology from factories in Ukraine. I think they're getting the engines. So that's pretty interesting. And I don't know, again, once again, you know, weapons technology is spreading all over the world. You know, a lot of people will be able to make drones. And of course, it's difficult, but it's not that difficult any longer. So here we have, you know, these Turkish people who are suffering from high inflation, Turkish-speaking people, and they're teaming up with Ukrainians and building these drones and selling them all over the place. And I think you told me that they even want to build a factory there in Ukraine. So, holy cow! You know, this is amazing, right? It's amazing.
Sure.
I mean, it's really complicated. So answering the question, it's not so easy. But I think you and I have just we presented a pretty good outline of what is really going on, you know, in Ukraine. I mean, it's not about NATO. Now, by the way, I one thing I should mention, that the old guard in Russia, Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, they probably have some fondness for the old days, meaning this communist days. But I think, generally speaking, the young people, say millennials or under 30, they're horrified at what their parents and grandparents had to live through. You know, they call it repressions, you know, killings, and you have to wait in line for you couldn't buy anything. You have to wait in line for food. It's horrors of this crazy Jewish communism thing, you know. So they don't really want to have anything to do with this old guard, you know, and I'm not sure they really support Putin that much. I don't know. But according to the State Department and Russia experts, you know, they probably do not. But I'm not sure about that. You know, and so that's another reason why the Ashkenazim in the United States think, oh, well, you know, we can take over Russia, because as time passes, you know, the old guard's gonna die, and we're gonna have the younger people who like us. You know, they're gonna be in charge. So see, and the same with Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
But one other thing I want to mention, it's really interesting. You know, back when I went to the Soviet Union for the first time in 1987, and or maybe it was 86, can't remember now. And, you know, obviously when the Soviet Union was there, and it was pretty interesting. I mean, I spent a couple of weeks in St. Petersburg and Moscow, and I had to do an organized tour, you know, with what I was married to, my wife, Catherine, and we were youngsters. So we did that. And I remember thinking, holy cow, you know, there's going to be a lot of, we went to Eastern Europe as well, you know, before and after the wall went down. And I remember thinking, okay, well, the consensus in the Western world is that Eastern Europe would develop very rapidly, spring back to life, you know, after being repressed by communism. And I remember being pretty skeptical of that, that thesis. And I argued that no, they would spring back, but they would never become very, very much equal partners of Western Europe or the United States or New Zealand, Australia, you know, Commonwealth. They wouldn't. And in fact, my cousin Edmund Leka, who was now basically de facto ruler of Albania, Edmund Leka and his brother Niko, they're my cousins, they told me, Edmund told me, he's about my age, maybe a little younger. He told me in 1992 or 3 or whatever it was, I went to Albania after the wall went down and they got a new government, you know, post-communist government. He told me, oh, you know, Greece is basically what we're going to rise to, the level of Greece. Albania is going to become Greece, you know, in 20 years or 30 years. And I politely, I was always polite with people, but I said, no, I don't think, I totally disagree with him. And I said, no, it'll never reach the level of Greece. And in fact, per capita GDP of Greece is, I think, something like, you can look it up, 16,000, 15,000, something like that. And Albania is 3,000 or 4,000 at the most. Mm-hmm. So it's been how long? It's been 30 years. They're never going to go anywhere. Now, the only Eastern European country that maybe has become pretty impressive is Slovenia. And I think they joined the European Monetary Union. I can't remember everything. That's why. But I think they're part of the European Monetary Union. But the other European countries, Eastern European countries, have not been able to join the European Monetary Union. And even though Germany and other influential members of the European Monetary Union allowed Greece to enter in 1999, I think it was, or 2000, or very early on, they decided to let Greece enter, even though there was really no evidence that Greece was capable of really being a responsible member, but they let them in, you know, so because they had ancient historical ties with Greece. So but Greece today is really, you know, really poor. And like I said, 15,000. And of course, most of Eastern Europe is still pretty, pretty miserably poor. I mean, it's their middle income there, but you know, obviously much better than they were 30 or 40 years ago. But they're still pretty backward. You know, and so they haven't reached a very high level of development, and I don't think they ever will. So, and that's probably going to be the case for Russia. So I don't know. It's a very interesting question. You know, when I took a train, final statement I would make when I took trains eastward into Eastern Europe, I was, you know, you leave Western Europe this is 40 years ago. And I said, my God, you're just going back in time. I went to Romania in the early 90s. You know, I went all over Eastern Bulgaria, really, really backward, feudal society. Right. I'm exaggerating, of course. It wasn't that bad, but you know, the Western Europeans could not be persuaded to look at communism before 1917 in the Bolshevik Revolution. You know, the Western Europeans were being told that, and we discussed this before, that you know, communism should be a way to go, and the Western Europeans were not that stupid, but the Eastern Europeans were. Mm-hmm. There was no bourgeoisie.
True.
And so that's my answer. I think I don't know you. So your turn to give me a critique or you know make your comment.
I still have one more question about Ukraine. Before my question is, what's the poverty or what's the GDP rate in Ukraine? Would you know that?
Oh yeah, I do. The GDP per capita is around $3,000 to $4,000, so roughly the same as Albania. In fact, some of the richer African countries have the same level. Now, it's admittedly true that there is a huge, I don't know how big, but I'd say huge is not an exaggeration, black economy. So obviously there may be more wealth in Ukraine that number suggests, right? It could, okay, fine. But I don't think it's that great. I mean, it's like a big swamp. It's that's why they put the Jews there, Ashkenazi Jews. I mean, it's not, without Russian technology and oil. They have no oil. They have a little bit. They have no resources. All they have is kind of an arable land that's kind of swamp arable land, and it's pretty bad. So I don't think they can do without Russia or the United States. They're totally dependent on outsiders to lift them up, and so that's why they're so bad off right now, because they're totally bankrupt, by the way. I think Yeah, that I wouldn't be surprised that most Ukrainians, Slavs, I don't know, ethnically. So I wouldn't be surprised that they really do want to be a part of Russia again. Yeah, they probably do. I wouldn't be surprised. Because they know they need the support, financial support, and the industrial support, and the connections. Yeah.
I didn't imagine Ukraine to be that complex. I mean, there's so many involved in that. The Jews, Ashkenazi Jews, I mean, the Greater Israel kind of thing. I mean, you mentioned.
Yeah.
And the Russians are not interested in that. NATO is interested in that. I mean, this is an area that is so small and so much poverty there. And yet it's attracting the attention of anybody and everybody there.
Yeah.
All the major players.
It really is. I mean, I didn't know until, I did know. I mean, there I did know. But I looked it up, according to the internet, 300,000 to 400,000 Ashkenazi Jews living in the Ukraine. And if it's true, and I'm sure, this is true, that 30% or more of young people in Israel, probably Ashkenazi Jews, want out. They want to leave Israel. They don't want to do military service. They don't believe in Zionism. They're fed up with the situation, right? It was only the old crowd that did this crazy shit of moving there and creating Israel. They're still committed, but I don't even know if they're committed. So the younger people, a large number of them want the hell out of Israel.
Sure.
So it's all over. And if that's true, and your argument has always been that they need the new blood, they needed the Sephardic Jews and they need these other Jews around the world to move to Israel so they can keep the thing going.
Yes.
Because when these geezers, old geezers, Zionists die off, and they are, right? They're going to die off in another 20 years. There's going to be most of these young people who don't like Israel. Instead, they don't want the idea of, they don't really fancy killing Arab children all the time, and to maintain their little fiefdom in the Fertile Crescent. It's crazy, or I should call it a ghetto. And by the way, the last thing I want to say is that the Ashkenazi Jews got so lucky here in the United States, right? And so they promoted this trading operation, right? Trading, consumer. Yeah, they were traders. They were traders in commerce people in the Pale. And they weren't allowed to do anything else. They weren't allowed to do medicine. They weren't allowed to do law. They couldn't do anything serious. They just were pawn shop owners and this kind of thing. So speculators. And so they built up this world that is heavily dependent on freedom of navigation, freedom of speech, freedom of moving around, doing whatever you want to do, and resources. A lot of consumption of resource, natural resources. On the other side are these Russians who were always autarkic. I guess the audience, if they don't know that word, they should look it up. But it means independent financially, economically, and so forth. So they were always autarkic, and they're still autarkic. And so you have this contrast between the Western world, which is, shaped by the Ashkenazim in the 20th century, and the Eastern world, which was never dominated by consumption, by personal consumption and personal freedom. It was based. They were just living a very simple life, that they lived for centuries. So we have this clash between the old way of doing things and this Ashkenazim way of doing things, which is, kind of chaos and sodomy routine, and everybody's doing everything they want to do, despite the obviously the problems that come with it.
Sure. I mean, I agree with you. I agree with your thesis that I don't think Putin is really interested in creating a war or creating a situation, and does look like it's the outside forces that have a much more interest in creating a chaos there.
Yeah.
And well, probably your thesis about Greater Israel looks interesting as well.
It is. However, I should say, just as a final thought here, that it wouldn't surprise me that the Russian military do a blitzkrieg and move into, in the right situation, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I'm thinking it's unlikely and they don't want to do it, but given the situation, if they're forced to, they will do it. If they're forced to.
If
they're forced to.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I would predict the Ukrainian government would totally collapse. The armed forces would collapse. There would be no resistance. Mm-hmm. I don't think there would be any resistance. Yeah. All right. Anyway, so that, I think I've said everything I wanted to say. You have any final thoughts?
No. I just wanted to say that I do agree with him a lot of what you said. And it does look, the things are kind of going to, sooner or later, things may kind of not get stirred up in there.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe if not now, maybe give it another year, maybe give it 6 months.
Yeah.
But sooner or later, they will kind of create chaos there.
Yeah. Well, one thing about war is that I said, you know, many times, you know, war between the United States and China, you know, it's so expensive. It's the United States is bankrupt. I mean, you never can say no, you know. I mean, there's always crazy. You can't predict the future. So I'm just going to say that it wouldn't shock me at all that Russia moves in militarily. It wouldn't shock me. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they want to. They rather achieve their aims without war, like von Clausewitz, I think it is, wage war with means short of war.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I think today we'll leave it at that. And I just want to thank you very, very much.
All right.
And hope to see, you know, we have another chat and listen soon.
Sure. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.